Thank you, Cole. I am delighted to be here. I think Cole and I have the record at the moment of being the only two people who've been to every conference. Is that right, do you think?
Maybe Cliff.
Maybe Judge Wallace. In any event, I'm delighted to be here. As Cole mentioned, I was fairly deeply involved in the initial application, development and application of the International Religious Freedom Act, which was an act that was designed by Congress to encourage the State Department to include the advancement of the principle of religious freedom as a more robust part of U.S. foreign policy. And as you know, foreign policy is largely left to the executive branch in the United States, and Congress generally believes that the executive branch is very good at advancing U.S. interests, but not always equally inclined to advance U.S. values. And so you see Congress attempting to create structures that will encourage a particular direction in foreign affairs, even though they fully, generally speaking, understand that the principal repository of power with respect to foreign affairs lies in the executive branch. But this was another example of their attempt to influence foreign affairs in a way that would encourage the State Department to consider the principle of religious freedom when formulating and executing U.S. foreign policy. And I'm going to focus on three principal parts of the legislation. Now, many of you from foreign countries are probably quite familiar with this legislation because it has not been perhaps as popular abroad as it has been in the United States. But for those of you not familiar with it, it did three things in particular I'll focus on today. The first is that it created an office within the State Department, as was mentioned earlier, headed by an ambassador that is appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. That office, and this is the second important point, is required to produce on an annual basis a report that reports on the state of religious liberties in countries across the globe and what the United States is doing to advance that interest in those particular countries. And then thirdly, it set up an independent policy group called the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Actually, it wasn't called that in legislation, but we like that name because the initials were SERF, and we thought that was easier to say. But that commission was a bipartisan commission with some commissioners appointed by the President, some by the Senate, and some by the House of Representatives, designed principally to give advice and counsel to the President, to the Department of State, to the legislature regarding ways in which one could accomplish the aims of the legislation. That is to say, to make policy prescriptions that could be considered by the Department of State and the administration in advancing those interests. So I'm going to spend just a few minutes today, and Cole said he will be brief. I will try to be brief as well, and talk a little bit from the perspective of someone who was very much down in the trenches of what I think that legislation and those institutions were successful in accomplishing. And I'm going to also suggest a few things that I think they were probably less successful in accomplishing. And I like to do that in particular because it follows the old Chinese maxim of being of engaging in self-criticism, a popular enterprise, because, of course, I was very much responsible for many of the activities of the commission. And therefore, as I'm pointing fingers, I think it's important to understand I'm pointing one at myself as well. As I've warned David, the State Department will not be entirely spared from some of my concerns. But in part, I do this out of a spirit of criticizing and pointing out areas for possible improvement, because I believe we really can't improve without honest, candid reflection on these matters. And certainly, I have spent time reflecting on that institution with which I had some interaction and responsibility. So let me start with the Department of State report, which I think in many ways has been the single most successful part of the legislation. This is a report that has a particular kind of power, and it has power in part because countries tend not to want to be singled out by the United States for bad behavior, and certainly don't want to be singled out in the world and international community for behavior that is considered somehow below that's expected of civilized nations. And what's important to understand is that the standard against which all is measured is not the U.S. perception of the appropriate way in which one makes space in the public square for religion, but rather is consistency with the international human rights treaties. And so the focus is not on the American sort of idiosyncratic version of religious liberties, but rather on those agreements that have much more widespread international consensus. And to be singled out is something that is disfavored by countries, and I know that because countries would often lobby rather diligently to have the reports written in certain ways, or particularly not to be designated under the statute as a country of particular concern, which was a country that was one that was considered particularly badly behaving with respect to religious freedoms. So there was a certain power in that. But underlying that was another power that I think was less recognized at the time, but also turned out to be important, which is it put in every embassy in the United States a person who was concerned about the issue of religious freedom. It increased the information flow available to the State Department and to the U.S. government with respect to what was going on in other countries. It forced people within the embassies to interact more extensively and more deeply with groups that were concerned about these issues, with human rights groups. And it, generally speaking, forced the U.S. government to engage in a dialogue with these countries about these issues, a dialogue that might not have been required had the State Department not actually been forced to put something in writing. It was a public report as well, which meant that, generally speaking, it was susceptible to criticism by the human rights groups, which meant it imposed a certain kind of candidness and integrity and honesty on the report that I think has been its hallmark ever since. And if it were criticized by these groups, both publicly and to the Congress, that was something the State Department obviously didn't want. And I think the report over time actually became quite good. But it also created an opportunity for a regular dialogue between Congress and the State Department on this issue. As the report was issued, as the people were required to issue the report and then report back to Congress, you entered into a robust and healthy dialogue where the Congress had an opportunity to explain what it was concerned about, and the State Department had an opportunity. I'm sorry, Cole, there goes your talk. The State Department, Cole's will be shorter than it otherwise we'd even anticipated. It had an opportunity for the State Department to explain the nuances and complications of dealing with particular countries so that they were able to come, at least on some occasions, to a closer mutual understanding of the best way to formulate and execute U.S. Foreign policy. In terms of the ambassadorial position and the Office of International Affairs, again, something that I think was initially thought to be and designed to be positive. It would put someone in the State Department who would worry about this issue and only this issue on a regular basis, therefore creating a bureaucratic presence and a bureaucratic channel to voice these concerns about this issue that sometimes is not able to be raised or sometimes isn't being raised within the normal bureaucratic channels. Regional bureaus and desk officers generally prefer not to rain criticism on the countries they're dealing with, and certainly ambassadors tend to be capable on occasion of extensive criticism of the countries to which they're accredited, but not often. And this presence in the State Department can be very helpful. But also has the opportunity for somebody who is committed to the issue, engaged in the human rights community, to understand the nuances and the complexities of formulating U.S. policy and of dealing with countries and trying to advance U.S. interests in very complex environments, and therefore serve as a spokesman externally on behalf of the U.S. government to the human rights community to try to engage in a better mutual understanding about what can be done, what should be done, and how those things might be done. It also would give somebody a bully pulpit, I don't know how the translators will deal with that, but an opportunity to both within the State Department and without the State Department to express concerns about either the state of religious liberties in a particular country or U.S. foreign policy with respect to that, particularly when the Department of State might not be responding effectively to legitimate concerns and complaints. And finally, let me turn to the Commission on International Religious Freedom. This, again, initially structured and conceptualized, I think, to be helpful and powerful, an independent, bipartisan voice to Congress, to the public, to the president, that was capable from a bit of a distance to review administrative policies and procedures, and most importantly, to work to formulate policy recommendations that might be both consistent with the interests of the United States, but also advance the values that the United States holds so dear and on which it operates. And if it operated effectively, could even force consideration, not necessarily agreement, but at least consideration consideration of those matters. So I think there were, as initially conceptualized, some promise and some strengths designed into this law. Now let me turn to a little bit more of the, so what happened in the last decade? How come religious liberty has not swept the world in light of this insightful and, as Cole said, unanimously supported law in Congress? Well, the answers are manifold, most of which have nothing to do with the International Religious Freedom Act, to be sure. But the Religious Freedom Act, I think it fair to say, or at least I suppose I would say, and therefore I think it's fair to say, certainly fair for me to say, I'm not sure it's entirely lived up to all of its promise. And I'm going to identify some of those areas, again, in part because it always seems to me a 10th anniversary is an opportunity for a little introspection, self-criticism, and perhaps if the congressional will is there, a little reexamination and perhaps even improvement in the law. So let me turn first to the Department of State report. The strength of the report, which I do continue to think is the strongest part of the law, is largely predicated on two elements. One is the credibility of the United States as a critic and the opprobrium that one suffers in the international community if, in fact, you are identified as not living up to your international obligations. Now, the challenge on both of those, certainly over the past certain number of years, is that at least on human rights issues, I think it is unarguable that the United States has had some decline in its credibility, its capacity to stand as a morally centered critic on some of these issues has, I think, by any fair estimation, declined. As that declines, the power of being identified by the U.S. Declines as well. The international arena has been more complicated. I think at the same time we have been expanding human rights treaties, I think the enforcement mechanism and the engagement and the willingness to point the finger at countries which are not living up to their international obligations has certainly not increased. And I think if you look at the European Union, for example, any fair assessment would have to say it's decreased. The European Union has a capacity to be remarkably feckless. See, I told you I'd be a sort of an equal opportunity criticizer, remarkably feckless if oil or commercial interests are involved. And you see that in a number of cases, Sudan being one of the principal ones. But if there isn't that international opprobrium that is rained on a country when named for not willing to comply with its various international obligations, there are very few other effective enforcement mechanisms in the international arena. So the report, while useful in many ways, I think, is only as useful as these informal enforcement mechanisms make it out to be, both of which I think have declined in the past decade. In addition, it is a unilateral report. And I think that has a certain kind of complication. If I had been Congress or King or capable of sort of a stroke of a pen changing things, one of the obligations I would have imposed very powerfully is a much stronger obligation on the United States to work multilaterally. And almost every element of the law actually pushes us in a unilateral direction. And I think that has a series of complications. And I think that there would be great utility in restructuring both the reporting requirements, the ambassadorial position within the State Department, and et cetera, in order to require much more extensive multilateral cooperation and operation in these areas than I think we have in the past. Let me turn finally, next to finally, I guess, the ambassadorial position. There, I think, my perception as an outsider who worked for a number of years in the State Department and then observing the State Department's actions rather closely outside, I think the ambassadorial position and the office have not really ever quite lived up to their promise. Now, I think at some large measure it is not their fault. And I want to be clear about that, because there is there's a whole set of, I think, structural problems in the way the office is set up. It's not a line office. And so there's no assured capacity to affect the career promotion and progression of people in the department, and therefore the capacity to pull the various levers of power that really get people to focus on the things they need to focus on is very difficult. It's situated awkwardly, even within the bureau within which it's situated, and the human rights people in the field writing the reports don't report to the ambassador, who is representing the substance of the issue. And therefore, it's not a particularly independent or powerful division within the department, merely sort of inserted within the department, obviously by a Congress, I don't think, that fully appreciated the bureaucratic complexities of the department or how U.S. foreign policy gets formulated. It has a quite small staff, no real levers of power. And so it depends a great deal on one's personal authority and credibility, and that really is quite critical. And because of where the ambassador's position is situated, it particularly doesn't have an ability to work multilaterally in exactly the way that I think would be much more calculated to be effective. And the people who have been appointed, while I think very dedicated and committed, I know they're both very well, very personally fond of both of them, neither possessed of significant bureaucratic experience prior to going into the department, and not a lot of indication of capacity to use the resources that are really available, and externally have been in this uncomfortable sort of netherworld between the department and between the human rights community. So being an interface representing the department to the human rights community has been compromised. Representing this issue within the department has been compromised, I think, as well. And while a great deal of very significant effort, passion, and commitment on the part of this area of the department, I think it was structurally designed in ways that tended to reduce rather considerably the possibilities for its effectiveness from the very beginning. I'm only marginally more complimentary of the commission. I think the commission has done some things very successfully, and when it has focused in a laser-like way on policy formations and used the tools that really are available to it, which frankly tend to be its relationship with Congress, it has had a capacity to be quite effective. And in the case of Sudan, for example, not the conflict with respect to Darfur, where I think the commission has not been particularly effective, but with respect to the North-South war that was occurring when the law was initially passed, it has been extraordinarily effective. But that is the exception, I think, and not the rule. Part of it has to do with the fact that I think the commission has tended to issue reports that to some degree are largely more descriptive of what's going on in the country than seriously wrestling with the challenging and difficult policy prescriptions where they could be actually very helpful. It has spent far too much time bogged down in the details of its reporting, in the particular way it describes things as though it were issuing UN proclamations and not simply reports to Congress and the President making some sort of policy recommendation that might stimulate particular debate. It has not focused adequately on developing serious, sustained, useful, efficient, effective policy recommendations that could help frame the debate with respect to U.S. foreign policy and this particular issue. Secondly, I think the Commission has suffered a bit from what I suppose I can say this, we're among friends, right? What is sort of the Senator Bill Bradley syndrome, which is once you say it, that's all you need to do. And the world kind of revolves around you're making a particular pronouncement. Well, it turns out the world doesn't work that way very much, but the Commission has largely made its pronouncements, even when it had policy recommendations, and then gone home to watch television, when in fact what the Commission needed to do was to develop a series of allies. Particularly, Congress could be very powerful. And again, if you look at their successes, the successes occurred when there was a deep interactive relationship between Congress and the Commission, not a lobbying relationship, but one where the policy recommendations had to be considered seriously by the administration because they were being seriously considered by Congress. And I could give some examples of that, but in the interest of time and in the interest of tantalizing you just a little bit, I won't do that. When it did that, it was effective, but it rarely did that, and I think diminished its effectiveness considerably. I also think it did not use its bully pulpit very well. The events, the hearings, and so forth, it had tended to be informative to the Commission, but not effective in terms of helping others understand the depth and magnitude and breadth of the problem. It was not effectively interactive with non-governmental organizations. And finally, I would add, I think the appointments were mixed in terms of their commitment to both the principal and in terms of their willingness to engage in the time they could devote to the enterprise. At least in the 7 years I served on the commission, I don't think we had a Muslim representative, for example, that was really deeply steeped in issues of human rights or religious freedom or that could describe in any way how one might better interact with the governments that had large Muslim populations or that were themselves Islamically oriented in order to identify ways in which this principle could be advanced even in those countries. So that's just one small example. There were others as well. So I think, I'll just conclude, that I do think the opportunity still exists out there. It is a principle about which the American people care deeply. It's a principle that for many theoretical, but I think I can cite an equally powerful number of practical reasons that advancement of the principle of religious freedom is extraordinarily important to creating the kind of societies with which we as a nation want to interact and in which we as a world want to live and see our citizens live. So I think it is a promising enterprise. It's a promise yet incomplete. Amendments that would require more multilateral engagement that could recreate within the department a more focused opportunity that was bureaucratically sensitive to really advance this issue and perhaps restructure the commission in a way that would enhance both its capacity to formulate its policy and its capacity to ensure that that policy would be at least part of the dialogue about religious liberties and foreign policy, and not merely a another set of very modest suggestions, kind of shot out into the world without a requirement of much deeper and much more engagement. So, with that, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you for a moment, and I will conclude by just saying, nevertheless, having said all that, I admire enormously and am grateful to live in a country that cares about these issues, both domestically and internationally. And it was indeed a great privilege to serve on the commission, to work with the people in the State Department, the Congress, and the White House who cared so passionately about these issues as well. I just wish we'd done better. Thank you.